WOWDLP Tacoma Park.
Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start to the day. We hope you can get your juice to talking about art as we do every other Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. We hope you enjoyed Meg very early in this morning with the eclectic music she has. It's amazing. We hope you enjoyed Rise Up this morning. This show brings out the kid in me every time. It's a program for young and old alike. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we are the hosts of the Artist Experience radio show.
Good morning. Artist Experience is an hour-long radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help you when you visit the exhibit, create in your soul, in your experience, your own work of art. The Artist Experience radio program has a unique mission. We look into the inward experiences of engagement with art, and we desire to make them explicit, both in the creator and in you, our listeners.
Today we're excitedly going to talk about with Sheila the art of nomads. That's right, the art made by nomads, specifically the art made by women in nomadic tribes of Anatolia. This program is inspired by a current exhibition at Washington's Great Textile Museum located on the campus of George Washington University and closely affiliated with this esteemed academic institution. The exhibition is titled A Nomad's Art, Kalims of Anatolia. This is one of those fabulous exhibitions hosted by the Textile Museum that is a world-class museum with world-class professionals working there. This exhibition has outstanding examples of Kalims from Anatolia. The museum is located near the Foggy Bottom Metro at 701 21st Street Northwest off of 21st and G Streets in Northwest. Check out the website at museum.gwu.edu. This exhibition could not have been made possible without the generous estate gift made by Murad Megali before his untimely death. He was a young, vibrant collector that made great connections with Josephine Powell, an anthropologist, photographer, and someone who documented well the life of nomads in Anatolia over her long and illustrious career. The exhibition displays more than 30 kalims from the Megali collection. These kalims are from the 18th and 19th century and are fabulous examples of this rich art tradition in the textile arts, made by women. Well, let's first talk about Anatolia. Anatolia means, the word, the land of the east in Greek, and it's anything east of Constantinople or present-day Istanbul. Today, Anatolia is modern-day Turkey, a vast and incredible country with great ethnic diversity. But today we are highlighting the work of women from nomadic tribes of mostly Turkic origin. And there are only a few exceptions in the show. Sheila, let me ask you, this is going to sound really like a peculiar question coming from the D.C. metro area, but have you ever met a nomad?
You know, I'm not sure. The traditional definition is a member of a people having no permanent dwelling, which is kind of different from homelessness, because nomads travel from place to place to find fresh pasture for their livestock. And that is in many ways a sustenance of the nomadic lifestyle. It's an ancient Greek word that means in search for pasture. A more urban contemporary definition is an individual that roams from place to place with no real home. It's not at all the same as being homeless. Nomads carry their homes with them, their children, their sheep herds, livestock, camels, and everything they need to live. They follow the seasons. Because of the nomadic way of life, woven fabrics, which were beautiful, but utilitarian also, weren't chronicled in any way. And it was only in 1982 that an important catalog was assembled. And it was very difficult to establish provenance, the date, the location, and the sequence of the stylistic developments from all these works of art. In this exhibit, there are fabulous photos of the nomads of Anatolia by Josephine Powell. She was an adventurer, a scholar, and a photographer. There's a photograph of a fragment of a rug from the 15th century, and then you can see pictures of the women cleaning the wool, weaving the textiles, arranging mattresses and pillows in the tent, which is also made of rugs. The hands of the women were gnarled and worn, and they're tying countless fringes of the rugs. These photos were taken in the 1980s.
Yeah, I know. So it's kind of a new recollection of academic studies in some ways, these kalims. Well, relatively new in terms. But, well, many years ago, Sheila, I saw this a series of photographs, titled Nomads, and it was by the famous contemporary photographer Andrew Serrano. And, of course, he became infamous with his infamous photograph titled Piss Christ, which got him a lot of trouble with a lot of people. And so he came out with another series titled Nomads. And I remember leaving the Nomads exhibition truly offended, as Serrano was photographing homeless people in a very elegant way. And homeless people, as you mentioned, are not nomads in any way, shape, or form. Okay, nomads are a group of people that, like Sheila said, that are self-sufficient unit, and they travel from place to place. Their grazing land is very important for their animals, because their animals supply just about everything in favorable weather. They barter and trade and grow themselves certain things that they can keep to be self-sufficient. Nomads traditionally have no boundaries, and I think this is really important when we talk about nomads.
Yeah.
They don't have a nation state or that they have allegiance to, except for maybe a group of nomadic tribal groups or federations, which are very hierarchical, and sometimes these federations or units defend themselves against other tribes, and they also work together in mass migrations in a more efficient way. But the fact is that nomads are not homeless, and the road and the migration is essential for their existence and their sufficiency. Well, they're traditional herders of sheep, goats, donkeys, and camels. Some nomadic groups might have some horses, mules, and maybe even a few cows, but they had large flocks, and they needed their animals to be healthy, to be fed for the market for their meat, for their wool, for their milk, and for their hides. which is very, very important. During the migration, the kalims were used to organize their possessions and often displayed kalims on the back of the camels of their caravans. And the beautiful kalims was also a sign of the mark of the weaver's skill and emblematic of this group. As an art form, okay? So this is, it's a lot more complicated than just throwing a kalim on a floor there. I mean, it becomes much more to the nomad. What is often referred to as nomadic culture is complex, and it has evolved and dissolved over the centuries as social, economic, and political changes in the landscape of nomadic lands have forced nomads from their traditional way of life. And this is actually a true tragedy, not only in contemporary Turkey, but in other places like Mongolia and in Iran with nomadic groups. The significance of these changes in the 20th and 21st century has been extreme to the lifestyle, and nomadism might not ever appear again. And it also has impacted the markers on these textiles, which is the women. This exhibition highlights the nomadic women's ability to express themselves in a beautiful and skillful way with cotton and wool and sometimes silk. The work by these women has mesmerized contemporary viewers of art and their artistic sophistication, color, and sense and innovation. Today we're saluting women and nomads, and what about these women, Sheila, because they did a lot of work.
Yes. Well, I'll start by saying that from the beginning of mankind, we've always had clothing, some kind of clothing. So the first clothing came into being 170,000 years ago. Humans knew about weaving since the Paleolithic era. Flax weavings were found in Egypt, dating from about 5,000 BC. Flax was the first popular fiber in ancient Egypt, and then it was replaced by wool in around 2000 BC. So from the beginning of counting time, weaving was known in all the great civilizations. Early looms needed one or two people to work on them. Many references to looms and weaving are found in the Bible. From prehistory through the early Middle Ages, for most of Europe, the Near East, and North Africa, two main types of looms dominated the textile production. These are the warp-weighted loom and the two-beam loom. The Anatolian ethnic groups wove for their own purposes as well as to sell. The Yoruks were one ethnic group that prized weaving. There were about 200,000 Turkmen tents near Denizli in western Anatolia, where kalims, slaves, and labor were traded. The materials, designs, colors, and methods of kalim weaving vary depending on their geography, their climate, their lifestyle, and community needs. Some groups of kalims are specific to a geographic region or culture, while others are harder to pin down. The movement of people, especially when caused by social and economic pressures, has resulted in the intermingling of groups, their designs, and their colors. The woven fabrics are not just decorative, but functional. They're used for everyday tasks. Tents, walls, rugs, as well as weddings, circumcision ceremonies, celebrations, and funerals. And these were the most colorful. Many motifs don't carry symbolic meaning or have changed over time, but a few do have symbolic meaning. The amulet, the eye, hand, a finger, tree, oil lamp. The weavers have never sat down to weave artworks, although they have been using age-old designs and colors. In fact, with the log weavings, the women can't see the whole of a piece until it's spread out after it's taken off the loom. So they often can't see the whole of the piece. They have to sort of imagine and guess as they're weaving it. And they were more than willing to exchange their kalims for machine-woven rugs and plastic household goods. Kalims that were donated to the mosques and became worn or threadbare through heavy use were often exchanged for wall-to-wall carpeting. Occasionally, they were stolen from mosques and sold in antique markets. It's an interesting contrast to the Aboriginal artists we talked about on a previous program. Maybe no government agency thought to build it into a cottage industry or saw that there could be a lucrative art market.
Well, you know, that's an interesting concept, and it's a complicated idea. Nomads usually do not do well with things like governmental agencies. Since nomads have no boundaries or an allegiance to a specific nation state in the true sense, in fact, there were most governments that wanted to stop the nomads from migrating, and traditional governments have been repressive to the nomadic culture for a host of sociologic, political, and economic reasons. So when you really think about it, it could be a similar parallel to our Native American tribes, right? Mm. The government, you know, some of them were nomadic, and the government wanted to repress that nomadism because they crossed state lines, borders, and so. So we have an American kind of phenomenon there as well about where nomadism doesn't work good for well for governments mm-hmm. in that sense. Well, the women do a lot of work, and they've been doing it for thousands of years in these nomadic cultures. But today we're talking about functional art, and the way the textiles were highlighted in this exhibition are amazing. They wove also things like Sheila had mentioned, dowries. They wove actually tent bands to secure their houses, reed screens, transport boxes, which are called mafrashes, and saddlebags, rugs, grain bags to put the grain in, and bags for the utensils like spoons and forks and things to cook with, and decorative accoutrements for their horses and their camels on the caravan. They decorated them with woven, you know, items. And of course, they wove the tents that they were living in with the wool from their goats or their sheep. So they were very busy, and yet they had to cook, prepare the food, the animals for the carding and the spinning of the wool. They had to take care of their children, of course, and not to mention things like yogurt making and milking the animals. So boy, that's a lot of work. And these nomads really had some, the women especially, really had some pressures and responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the hierarchical thing, the men take care of the sheep, and they shear the wool, and then the women spin the wool to a fine, slightly irregular thread, and it's this irregularity that makes the rugs more beautiful. Spinning could be done while walking, and by anyone from grandfather to grandchild, so you could walk in a caravan and have the and be spinning the wool at the same time. Then the dyes are prepared by the men. And the dyes are natural dyes, madder root, indigo, St. John's wort, onion, saffron, sumac, chamomile, rhubarb, turmeric, sage, poppy, buckthorn, quince, almond, walnut, pomegranate, chestnut, and henna are just a few of the long list of natural dye sources, with madder and indigo perhaps the most commonly used. But what makes dyeing with natural pigment sources approach the esoteric is the fact that in order to achieve a particular hue of color, the elements of the brew must be just right, or the resulting shade will be off from what it was intended. That means that at least three fundamental variables are there: the quality and amount of the dyeing agent, the quality and temperature of the water, and the time allotted to soaking. It must be correctly proportioned in a particular application of the wool. Sometimes camel hair is added, but not frequently, because the camel hair is kind of a brown, tawny color. But sometimes the camel hair itself, not dyed, is added. And sometimes a bright white cotton is stitched over the cloth for decoration. This is to this already complicated brew, yet another ingredient is added, namely a fixative, a bonding agent known as mordant. It is applied to the wool before, often during, and occasionally after dyeing, known as mordanting. This process has its ancient roots in China and India, reportedly passing to Europe via Persia and Turkey. Mordants include the metal compounds alum, copper sulfate, chrome, ferrous sulfate, and tin. Tannin and urine are also used. With this, the natural dyes are much more stable than chemical dyes, and of course the colors are vibrant, soft, and subtle. With these colors in any combination, you almost can't go wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
They're so beautiful, but the studying patterns are so gorgeous. And I want to say that the impulse to make these rugs into works of art is innate. because there's no reason that they had to be beautiful when they're utilitarian, but they really are. And the women are the creative force behind these rugs.
Yeah, that's a great point.
They do the actual weaving, and they work with such skill and precision. So even though the motifs are passed down, they are used in inventive ways. When you walk into the exhibit, you're just dumbfounded by the beauty of the Kalims. I mean, the colors themselves, since they have variation of dark and light within them, each color block. And then the combinations are just sumptuous. Just by themselves, you have to say, oh, that's the most gorgeous yellow, and it's next to an indigo or a green. The designs are crisp, and because of the weaving method, there are big enough blocks for each color to just feast your eyes on that particular color. The designs do not overwhelm the color. They are completely in harmony. The weaver started with a motif. Then she'd weave the background areas at either side. And because of the limitations of the weaving process, the weaver has to understand what is possible. The different colored weft yarns turn back using adjacent warp yarns, resulting in a vertical slit. There can be no straight vertical lines for very long because of the slits, so the lines almost always went at an angle. The design is built up of small areas of solid color. Each is woven with its own weft yarn. Weft yarns from adjacent areas never interlock or intermingle. In this manner, the artistic expression of the Kalim and its technique are inextricably bound together. The looms were narrow, so that often the designs were woven in two parts and then sewn together, and there's an irregularity in sewing them together that's also part of the visual fascination. Also, the rugs are often made on a vertical loom, but meant to be viewed horizontally. How did they do that? Makes me say that. Yeah. How did they do that? Tapestry weave inherently limits the ability to create curvilinear forms unless the weaver has the necessary equipment, the time, experience, and know-how, and more importantly, very fine, thin threads. In creating their designs, Anatolian weavers seem to have accepted the natural limitations of the material and technique and developed a design repertoire that's essentially rectilinear. It's geometric, it's non-representational, whereas the designs probably came from the natural world around them. So we have been swaddled in fabric since we were born. Probably if we went back to our first memories, it would be a blanket or some soft feeling on our baby faces. And then the rug we learned to walk on. I remember some brown mottled carpet when I was really little, and my favorite blue and yellow baby blanket, or my brother's striped polo shirt. And we furnish our homes with rugs and curtains and upholstery and probably never give much thought to who made them and the origin of the patterns. I've had Kalim rugs for years because they're pretty and inexpensive, and never thought much about their origins apart from the store where I bought them. So it's kind of fascinating, as it often is during the show, to have my eyes opened.
Well, that's really good, Sheila. And thank you for sharing about the technical aspects of the dyeing, because it's a very complicated affair. And we're talking about Kalims here, and Kalim is a Turkish word, and in Persian it's Gelim. It's also very similar, and there are many kinds of Middle Eastern textiles are woven in this fashion. These are woven on vertical looms, sometimes ground looms, and the key is that they don't have pile. That's something we need to really get across here, because the knotted addition is to the warp, and these do not have that. This is just straight warp and weft, with an occasional supplementary weave put after that. And so we are looking at primarily at tapestry weaving, and the colors change on that particular warp thread, as Sheila mentioned. And it's very, very important to understand that the technical limitations kind of create what these geometries are, and that the weavers had a face in the movement going through these kalims. So it's sort of an artistic kind of engineering dilemma for the weavers. And the joy of these weavings is really about color, color, and color. And I think that's why we respond to these in such a modern way. And these women, they never took a class in color theory, Sheila. I mean, we had to go through that, you know, in college. You know, no color theory at all, but they have this incredible innate sense of color and color combinations with the concepts of hues and color intensity and saturation that make for beautiful textiles. Well, these natural colors, they did it so masterfully. And so why don't we kind of talk a little about that and in their color sense?
Well, I'd love to. I love just remembering the colors. The natural dyes are softer than our chemical dyes today. They're subtle. Not like the basic primary and secondary colors on the color chart, like red, yellow, and blue. They just do harmonize with each other, but it's more than that. Each particular rug in this collection has its own color palette, and just to look at them, the colors had to have been decided on in advance because the combinations will just knock you out, and they have a logic within each piece. It's not like the weaver decided, oh, to stick some orange in as a surprise or something. But because of the weaving technique, the design of is built up of small areas of solid color. Each is woven with its own weft yarn. Weft yarns from adjacent areas never interlock or intermingle, but within each color, the weaving process just naturally lends itself to positive, negative shapes. When the weaver begins with a figure and then fills in the background, there's an opportunity for the positive becoming the negative. And when the colors are used to enhance that effect, either by value or color contrast or both, there are some eye-popping effects. But within this, they still retain a softness. The artistic expression of the Kalim and its technique are inextricably bound together. Tapestry weaving inherently limits the ability to create those curvilinear forms. And unless the weaver has the necessary equipment, but it's that they are limited in what they can do that leads to these amazing patterns.
Yeah, that's it. Mm. I mean, that's where the art comes in.
Yes.
And I think that's where we have to appreciate that. Well, when you look at these old textiles, we often say that they have a patina. The color has changed from the original through the elements of sun fading and wear, but still the Kalim maintains an incredible amount of beauty even in its older version. A friend of mine used to say that the weaver would not recognize her work 150 years later after it was woven, because the Kalim had changed, in some ways mellowed and harmonized in over time. And I think that's amazing. There's nothing garish in these Kalims.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. You know, and a lot of these modern Kalims that we see, they throw in this horrible cyan blue or this orange that just, you know, makes your flesh crawl. But it's visually, I mean, this is not about that. It's amazing. And there is something to be said that these nomadic women were also making for part of their dowries. And so there was a utilitarian need and for the nomadic community at large to use these things. So I think there's we didn't say this before, but there's such a love inherent in this process. They're making it for their family status, they're making it for their family, for their possibly tribe. And I think that's something that art, we don't usually talk much about art and love, but you know, I think that's something that we really need to, because these people are doing out of sheer love. Now, many of the Kalims in the exhibition are done in halves. They're shown in halves. They've been disassembled in the past, and they've possibly been sold or separated, you know, in different places. So these Kalims, you know, don't exist in their entirety, but there are some that do in the exhibition, and it makes them so much more magnificent and exponentially more powerful. So, you know, don't think you're seeing the whole thing a lot in this exhibit. You're seeing half of a Kalim. And there's much documented evidence on the love of the textiles of all over Europe. And I think this is something we've learned more about Kalims from European artists than from academics themselves, because they've documented these things. And many artists have proudly displayed the textiles and inspired their art forms. There's actually a book out now, and it escapes me the title, about artists and textiles and how they put them all over their studios throughout Europe. It was almost like a way of showing their love for art. Mm-hmm. They used to go. They used to buy, you know, textiles from all parts of the world, and that's and show them in their studios. You know, Bohemian kind of style, which we like. And as early as the 15th century, these artists depicted rugs and kalims in their paintings. And we've talked about this previously at the Vermeer show that we talked about last year. Artists have been instrumental in documenting the history of weaving through their paintings. So much about their certain graphic motifs, that certain graphic motifs, and sometimes in kalims, are actually named after the artist that painted them. For instance, we have the Memling Ghoul, which is a flower form. The ghoul is a flower form, and it's painted by the famous German artist Hans Memling in the 1400s. So that's an interesting thing. And then there's Lorenzo Lotto, who's a Venetian mannerist painter who worked in the late Renaissance as well. And he had a carpet motif named after him, as well as something called the Lotto carpet, which is a very famous carpet with a series of designs. And that's an Ottoman rug. So there's a lot of evidence to this. But Sheila, when you were on the show, you just kind of screamed when you saw some of these kalims, because it was very evident that one of your favorites, Henri Matisse, use these kalims as well, right?
Yes, because Matisse, his family had, for generations, they'd been in the textile industry in northern France. So Matisse grew up with textiles all around him, and he had an appreciation for textiles from his childhood, and he was an avid collector of fabrics, even from his early days as a poor art student in Paris, and then in the latter years of his life, where his niece's studio just overflowed with exotic costumes and wall hangings. At first, they were background elements in his compositions, and then textiles soon became like the springboard for his radical experiments with perspective and an art based on decorative patterning and pure harmonies of color and line. And if you look at his middle paintings, when he really started to really get what these textiles could do, there's a sort of, it's like you don't know if you're looking at a textile pattern or a figure. They're all interwoven. And so Picasso was an abstract painter. And so he didn't need his visual world, the world around him, but Matisse was filling his world with things to paint, and especially fabrics. He had fabrics from all over the world, from North Africa, from the Orient, from Turkey. And after World War I, Matisse, he went to Nice to live and work. The war was terrible. His children had left home, and he was depressed. So he'd hire models who would dress in North African costumes and posed among the carpets, the cushions, the screens, draped with fabrics. They became like more like a collaboration. I mean, they were his inspiration. And the emphasis on chromatic brilliance and decorative patterning is taking to such extremes in these works, in which the sinuous lines and the forms of his models appear to merge with the richly oriental ornamental elements of their surroundings, so that really you don't know if the models are just a part of the whole patterning. There's a fantastic exhibit there was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where the textiles from Matisse's library, he called them his library, were paired with the paintings. There was a Romanian peasant blouse from Matisse's textile collection that were worn by his female sitters in a series of pen and ink drawings, and in one of his most famous paintings, La Rêve, like the dream. His patterns, curtains and rugs were as much the subject of his paintings as were the models. There were many artists who were also inspired by designs and kalims and carpets from the Orient.
Yes, I mean, it's a whole host of them. And thankfully, these artists did depict them, because we know more about these kalims and rugs because of the artist's documentation. Mm-hmm.
So let's listen to some exotic Turkish music. And we will be back. ¶¶
One of the things is that I have to say about these Kalims is that I marvel at the women and what they do with the wool and the colored yarns. And this is, excuse me, really true art. And, you know, Sheila, you know, a lot of times we put this kind of work in craft.
Yes.
We kind of label it in craft. And in so many ways, it's not craft. And I wanted you to talk a little about that, because I think the notion is changing. You know, we used to say, oh, that's women's work, right?
Right.
You know, they weave the stuff, and that's, you know, it's not put in the category of high art. And for sure, this is high art. Address that a little.
I'd love to. There were two women artists in the 70s who addressed this. One is Miriam Shapiro, and she said, I am an artist looking for legitimate ancestry. I wanted to validate the traditional activities of women, to connect myself with the unknown women artists who made quilts, who had done the invisible woman's work of civilization. And so she, in her mid-career, changed her art to be all about weaving textiles, patterns, sewing. She incorporated elements of craft and what was considered low art, and that had been excluded from the realm of fine art and merely described as woman's work. So she sought to elevate these female traditions and place them alongside oil painting and classical drawing as equals by combining these materials and processes with visual elements. The style that she used sort of to juxtapose patterns on patterns became what was called the pattern and decoration movement, also called P&D. And this style emphasized the visual patterns of the marginalized media, such as quilting, fabric design, or wallpaper, in an attempt to redefine abstraction beyond the Euro-American male-dominated movements of the 20th century. Shapiro embraced the decorative as a positive quality, fighting against artistic snobbery that had long dismissed decoration as a trivial sign of inferior art or craft, often with associations of femininity.
Well, thank goodness that stuff is changing, you know, and these women deserve to be put in the art category, you know, as opposed to craft. And, well, I think also we overlook the power and sophistication of the graphics in the textiles. So often that we were inspired in our everyday lives, these nomads simplified complex natural objects in beautiful ways with the limitations of the technical aspects of the loom and the weaving of curvilinear forms on the loom, which makes things more geometric. Well, It's amazing what they did with these simple geometric shapes. I mean, the design lexicon is huge, and that these weavers, what these weavers did with wool to communicate them is difficult and still beautiful. So let's talk a little about that. We have things like evil eyes. We have things like figures. We have things like arms. The list goes on and on. And then there's waveforms, which is also called the running dog. These are beautiful elements that nomads use. And of course, water and dogs are so important in nomadic life. So they're really expressing themselves and their life around them. And then we have ram's horns, bird's heads. We have flower forms and bud forms like carnations, nectarines, and some other kinds of flowers. I have other kinds of flora. Oh my goodness, I'm so sorry about this. I'm just, all of a sudden I've got a cold here on the air. I've never had this happen before. Well, anyway, and there's dendritic forms like strata and mountain ranges. The most important and possibly oldest form is one called the Elabelinde form, which is an anthropomorphic form. And this is really gorgeous on many of the kalims in the exhibitions. It's an abstracted human form with hands on hips, which most often looks like a female variety. This symbol is associated with fertility and childbirth, and it's very, very old. There are lots of theories that it might be a goddess motif, and or is it a weaver proudly depicting herself in defiant ways and about her own weaving? We'll never know, but it exists in many of the weavings in the exhibition. And this nomad and tribal woman is doing this in her weaving, and it seems almost kind of like she's mentioning her femininity in this too. I think that's very, very important.
Yes.
That, you know, there's children around the tent, she's weaving, she has so many responsibilities, yet she puts herself into the work. And I think that's something we don't talk about enough about art. She's putting herself in the work in some kind of subtle autobiographical way. And to me, that's really touching. You know, because it takes a long time to do these things, and she's putting herself in there.
Yeah, I also want to mention that when these weavings get really seen is in the caravans. They're used to cover the camels and the household goods, and they're displayed. So that's when they really get to be seen by the other, you know, by the people in the tribes. The weaving begins at the bottom and it progresses upward. And then when it becomes hard to reach the weaving edge, the woman rolls the part she has woven onto the lower beam. After this, she never sees what she's woven until the finished textile is taken off the loom. Any change in the warp tension that may occur by unrolling and rolling again will cause the designs to distort. So the weaver either has to rely on her memory of the motifs, designs, and colors she's used, or use an older kalim as a weaving aid.
Like a visual aid,
as
like
a
next
visual
to her.
Aid, yes.
To show her what to do.
Yeah,
oh, I gotcha.
That's really sharp. This aspect often causes inconsistency between designs and colors from one end of the kalim to the other. Nowadays, weavers are attracted to metal looms instead of wooden ones because the metal looms do not warp and they last longer and they're less expensive and they're lighter. When kalims are woven as two separate panels and are combined, the differences between the design and color can be very common. The thicknesses of the yarns differ depending on the spinner. The yarns dyed at separate times in different vats will also have a different color tone. And boy, does that ever add to the beauty. It really does. Those different nuances of colors. So the weavers like to sometimes add small details to the patterns. And the size of the kalims have been determined by their function. So sometimes they are overstitched with just a little design motif, sometimes in a bright color or a bright white. The Yoruks, whose livelihood was based on nomadic animal husbandry, needed large bags to carry the household items and to cover the camels that carried their belongings during migration. Kalims for camel loads have a distinct design layout because the center of the kalim was left undecorated with a red background. Whatever function the Kalim served at a given time, care was taken to create beautiful design during its weaving. Yurks believed that the respect a woman garnered was proportional to her weaving abilities. I love that.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So the Yurks no longer had, they don't have the camels anymore, so the Kalim lengths became shorter. And the color palette also turned towards the darker shades at this point. And you don't know if this darkness is reflecting part of the mood of losing their way of life. Some Kalims have specific functions. We've mentioned there's one such function that was used during the bridal party for the bride to sit on while henna was put on her hands. And later that night, the same Kalim covering her during sleep. Another Kalim was woven specifically for weddings and funerals. The Kalim was loaded on top of the first camel in the wedding caravan, and then later it was spread as cover for the bridal bed. The same Kalim was later used in a funeral to wrap the deceased.
You know, many years ago, with the there was a tragedy in Armenia, and the with this huge earthquake. It may have been maybe been about 20 years ago, and I remember on the news they were burying the people in their kalims.
Oh.
The tragedy of the earthquake, and it was like, oh my goodness, these people were being buried in the kalims, and the women, you know, probably wove them. So it was very touching to see that. I mean, they used these kalims to eat on. Dining kalims, they to make bread on. So it's really such an important facet of everyday life. You know, in one of our first shows, we talked about the concepts of perfection in making art. And Sheila alluded to a little before, and this just doesn't exist in these kalims. You know, when you see a color change, or when you see the graphic is suddenly off, it isn't the same design, I think a lot of people get kind of turned off, like, oh, the weaver really didn't know what she was doing. But the fact of the matter is, that adds to the power of it. And I call this putting the hand in the work.
Yeah.
You know, the hand becomes part of the work. And they do it so boldly and beautifully in these kalims on so many levels. There's nothing boring or mechanical about these kalims that you would see in a modern-day kalim that you would buy. I mean, I'm not going to mention any places to buy kalims, but, you know, you go to a store and you buy a kalim, it's like, it's almost perfect in a really mechanical, non-handmade way. And a lot of them nowadays, of course, are not made by hand. They're totally made on a loom without a person working it. So we have to be very careful about that. But, you know, just think about it. The weaver grabs another piece of wool right there in front of her. It's a similar color. It's not the same. And it's from a different dye batch. And she puts it right into the kalim. Well, it creates color vibrations on many levels. And the colors vary. And this is called an abrash, where there's a piece of the kalim has one color and slightly different color of another dye batch woven in. And that's called, again, it's a great word, a brosh. And it's the slight, subtle changes that might occur through dye colors. The other thing I wanted to talk about is that sometimes with a double dye, a green, for instance, is a double dyed product. It is yellow and indigo, some kind of yellow and indigo, and it's a double dye process to get the green. Mm-hmm. Orange could be similar. It's a madder product with some yellow. Sometimes an orange could be made that way. Well, in the double dyed, sometimes the yellow comes through a little more, sometimes the blue comes a little more, so you get these vibrations of changes of color. So I always said when you see a green and an orange in a kalim, it adds so much vibrancy to it because the green is changing in its color.
Yes.
Block shape. And so, in other words, nothing is perfect in these kalims, and I think that adds to the beauty of them. And the improvisational nature of these supplementary weaving and motifs on top of the warp and weft is very surprising and imaginative. So there's a lot to see in this exhibition. And we really have kind of understand the visual variety that actually exists in these older kalims. They're full of surprises. And then we can tell that the weaver is having fun.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's not sweating. She's enjoying her work.
Right.
And there's something about that in art making that's really important. So there isn't one kalim that's of a predictable variety in this show. And you'll see the difference between contemporary kalims and those kalims, and it'll make a huge difference in your visual taste of kalims when you see this exhibition.
Yeah, I wonder if you've come in my house and kind of gagged at my
I don't usually do that with my friend Sheila.
Okay, all right. But you know about it. So and I also want to say that there are wonderful films or videos in the exhibition of women weaving the kalims, and they're sitting, they'll be all in a row and all weaving, and they're the efficiency and how quickly their hands and fingers are moving, and they look, it's like very cheerful. I hope they really are cheerful, but you see it's like the not just practice, but it's almost innate, the way their
it's like a discipline in some ways.
Work their ways through these wefts and warps and still keep track of what's happening in the pattern as a whole. So I'm going to talk about what my favorite kalim is. Okay, there was one that just, I don't know, it just stood out, and after I left the show, I kept thinking about it. And then I luckily there was a picture in the catalog that I could just feast my eyes on. It's so beautiful. So it's from the first half of the 19th century, and the undyed white, which is used for the warp, is underlies everything. And then there's an indigo blue and a red and an eggplant purple, and there's some bits of golden orange, and as Tom was saying, that orange changes. It's not always the same golden orange. And I love it because the white, which is really very much part of this in the positive negative shapes, it functions sometimes as negative, so sometimes it's positive, so that your eye fights back and forth. But it's not really fighting. It's activated by having to decide which is the pattern and which is the background, because they both function in that way. It's really sophisticated. And on the border, the same idea of positive negative repeats in a lower key, you know, a darker key, blues and reds with much less contrast. I think it's really impossible to get someone excited by a verbal description, but perhaps with this guidance, the viewer can see something of why these designs are so visually exciting.
Well, yeah, there's so many to talk about. And one of the things about the exhibition, they have this wonderful little brochure, A Nomad's Art, Kalims of Anatolia, that's in the gallery space. And you've got to grab this really tasteful brochure. It really kind of highlights the show. And there's so many of these wonderful, wonderful kalims to talk about. But there was a kalim that I'm going to talk about that was the smallest one in the exhibition. And it looked like a very primitive prayer kalim, and which is not rare in the kalim form for weaving in Anatolia. But for this particular one, it was so simple. And it was it looked like it was really old, but it was hardly ever worn. The saturation of the dyes, which is something that really was astounding in this exhibition, in this particular weaving, was absolutely fabulous. It was these simple blocks of pale yellow and madder red and kind of a reddish brown. And, you know, at the top of the prayer kalim is this mihrab niche, and it was a pistachio green. I mean, there was the only color that was pistachio green. And that green just jumped out in this simple triangle at the top. It was so modern in its evolution, that kalim, as the weaver was going up the loom. I mean, and it was a real winner. And it was the only prayer kalim in the show. So I think that was really, really fabulous. And, you know, I think for our listeners, the viewing impact of this show is just, you know, just right on your face, powerful.
Yeah. I also want to say that although it just seems to me that Matisse, because of his love for patterns, as he got older, he became a master of cut papers. It was his, and at a certain point, he wasn't painting anymore. He was sitting in bed with a great scissors, drawing with his scissors these beautiful shapes. And when you look at these Kalims, you think Matisse is either channeling them or dreaming about them, but these, or has seen them. We don't know. But they're in his, when his last work, his great work, was the Vence Chapel in the south of France. And he used these this cut paper method to make stained glass windows and also the vestments for the clergy. And these motifs in the vestments look like so much of what you're describing about, Tom, in the in the Kalims. And so I wanted to say that since I've known you, I knew that you had an obsession for rugs because you would talk about it. And I really just sort of was polite about it. I didn't really notice, you know, like, okay, you like rugs. And I didn't really understand it. I mean, why would you buy a rug if you don't really need one for your floor? And then you would say, oh, I bought another rug. And so I was just kind of, And once you explained it to me that knowing about these rugs and appreciating the unique qualities and the beauty, well, you have to own it. I've never really gotten it until now when I went to see the show with you. It was such a treat. You made me love these rugs too. I've been staring at the catalog all week and you've just transferred that love to me. So learning about them has been a treat. And for me, the combinations of colors and patterns with the size and the irregularities, they're just perfectly to my taste. Not in a superficial way, but they resonate beauty deep in my soul. So I want to thank you. I get it.
All right. I'm so glad, Sheila. And I thank you for appreciating my pathology all these years with my love of textiles. Well, we're talking about beauty here on our radio program, and that's what it's all about. But the exhibition titled Nomads Art, Kalims of Anatolia, goes through December 23rd. You can tell we're very excited about this expression by nomadic women weavers. We hope you've enjoyed the show, and we hope you could get out to see the Textile Museum and enjoy the exhibition. Experience art in everything you see and the visuals that you see, and do it every part of your life. And we appreciate that, and thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Üsküdar'a giderken aldı da bir yağmur. Üsküdar'a giderken aldı da bir yağmur. Katibimin satırızı uzun etey camur. Katibimin satırızı uzun etey camur. Katib uykudan uyanmış gözleri mahmur. Katib uykudan uyanmış gözleri mahmur. Katibin min bin katibin elle karışur. Katibin mi satırete palto ne güzel yaraşur.
Üsküdar is a little town in Turkey, and in the old days many women had male secretaries. Oh well, that's Turkey.
Üsküdar'a giderken bir mendil buldum. Üsküdar'a giderken bir mendil buldum. Mendilimin içine de lokum doldurdum. Mendilimin içine de lokum doldurdum.
They take a trip from Üsküdar'a in the rain, and on the way they fall in love. He's wearing a stiff collar and a full-dress suit. She looks at him longingly through her veil and casually feeds him candy. Oh, those Turks!
Katibim ara iken yandım da buldum. Katibim ara iken andım da buldum.
kyati benem bin kyati ben el karışur kyati ben mehkolal da gamlık ne güzel yaraşur kyati bim ara iken yandem da buldum kyati bim ara iken yandem da buldum Kyati bimin bin kyati bin el karışur Kyati bim mühkül alı da gümlük ne güzel yaraşur Kyati bim mühkül alı da gümlük ne güzel yaraşur